I'm going to record. There we go. We're on.
Okay.
So hi, everybody. Welcome to Smart People, Dumb Brain. This is going to be our third episode. On our second episode, we talked a little bit about doing some somatic work. And so Dr. Faith is going to be leading that conversation. I will be kind of on the sidelines. We have people with us. So if they have questions, they're going to be chatting kind of on the sides, and I will kind of present a question for everybody. So, Faith, what do you want to say?
Hey, everybody. So the question that came up, a lot of the people who are logged in are supervisors, supervisees, colleagues, people who do similar work in the field. And something that had come up a few weeks ago was the idea of when we're doing all this work by distance, and it's going to be this way for a while, at least with some people that are more immunocompromised, those kinds of things. How do we do somatic work when we can't recognize people's energy, we can't feel their anxiety in the room? How do we help them through that work when we're doing distance counseling, either by video where we can see some body language, or by phone where we can't really do anything but hear voice? And so that was how we came up with the topic. So two birds, one stone, we decided to make it our supervision session as well, since it was supervisees who asked about this, and we thought, well, let's also record it because other people are probably having this question. I do a lot of somatic-based work in my practice. And even though I've also been doing distance counseling for a few years, I do have clients elsewhere in the state. I had to really figure out, if I'm really going to do somatic work, like brain spotting, which is a form of EMDR that uses somatic experiencing, or those kinds of things, I had to get a little bit more creative with it and pay attention to it. It became more overt, and I had to get more creative. There's a fantastic book I like called My Grandmother's Hands, and the individual who wrote it was, the book is very much about the effects of racism as a trauma, as an intergenerational trauma, and it's also very much a somatically based book. And so one of the things that he said when I read the book a couple of years ago that really struck me is, he's like, 90% of therapy is having a calm nervous system, so the individuals that we're working with can come in and they can attune to our nervous system. That's where we're holding space, that they can come in, they can relax, and they have a safe place to do the work. And then there's only so much of that we can do in distance counseling. They're not actually regulating in a physical way off of somebody else's nervous system in the room. And so I've had to help people do that. And I had a client that said, it's way harder to do it. I like being in your office where I just get to sit, I sit in there, and it's like this very natural part of our process. And it's much, much harder when you're having to coach me through it. And so she noticed that. She's like, I recognize that this is a big part of the work that I do, is being able to regulate sort of off of your calm nervous system and not having that. And for people who that sounds really woo-woo and new agey vibey, I get that. But the analogy that I use all the time is, have you ever walked in a room where everybody's really calm, but you can tell that there had been like a fight, that there was an argument, there was, like a cold war going on between people, like you could feel the energy that things were actually not okay? We've all had that experience. So there definitely is something about how our nervous systems transmit energy in this very electrical way that we can feel in a room. And so how do we help our clients do that when we can't be physically present with them to hold that space for them in a physical way? How do we teach them to do it for themselves? And anything you want to add to that, Brenda?
I think that when we talked about this, and I kind of was just kind of thinking about it and how we were going to present it, I kind of thought about attunement. And for me, I'm very visual, and I do a lot of training, and I think we all do training, but I do a lot of very specific training about body language. So being able to really check in into those micro expressions for me is really important to kind of help and kind of point out, because we're not sitting face to face. but being able to point these, those things out, to be able to help them attune to kind of where mm-hmm. I am at, where I'm calm. And even though they might be activated, we can kind of coach them through just kind of sitting here if they can attune to where I am, even through video chat. And I find it's very, I think that it's actually very similar to them sitting here in with us in person. I mean, there are those special challenges, but I think that clients have been, especially when you have a built relationship with them, to be able to do it fairly easily, when you can kind of pick out those micro expressions for them if they don't catch it. Yeah.
And with that too, you probably didn't, sorry, I'm buffering. So if I'm interrupting you, I'm not trying to be an asshole. I always let you know when I'm actually trying to be an asshole. So. Yeah. If I interrupt anybody, it's because I'm buffering because I have crappy internet because I live on the east side. So I like to, if I notice it, if it's a client that I know really well, I may call it out very pragmatically. It's like, oh, that just pissed you off. What's up with that? Depends on the client. Sometimes I'll say, oh, okay, well, you had a really strong reaction to that. What's that about? Mm-hmm. Depends on the client. If I know somebody really well, I'm like, oh girl, you just got pissed at me, and they'll laugh and they'll own it. But you know, you got to be careful with how you call it out too, depending on the person that you're working with. You may just want to say, hey, your shoulders went way up, or, you know, I can tell you're really thinking right now, or, you know, what's going on? I just saw your body really change right now. What's that about? And we can definitely do that by video. And with phone, I just call it out by phone. I'm like, I can't see your body language right now, but I really noticed your voice changed. What happened there? Or, you know, your tone got deeper, or, you know, whatever it is that we're paying attention to. And I said, I'm limited in my cues right now, but I just noticed a really big difference in your voice. You know, what's going on? So that can be something that, yeah, tell me. And the big thing I'm trying to lead people through this process of calming their own nervous systems when they can't calibrate off mine. And, you know, I know that when I read that book, I'm like, yeah, that's so true. That is 90% of therapy. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if I really understood that until my clients who really need that the most and couldn't get that when we were working from home. And then they think it's weird, but I'm like, okay, so let's try it this way. But I have found it to be very, very helpful. And I use a lot of stuff that comes from like somatic experiencing is, helping them go. So, you know, in our bodies, we're talking about feeling into our bodies. We're talking about interoception, that understanding of the insides of our bodies and what we're feeling, and helping people feel like where is the activation? So we're thinking about the thing that's upsetting us, whatever the core issue is, the fear, the anxiety, where is that in the body? And most people are not used to feeling that stuff, especially if they've been told not to feel that way, that they're wrong. We get very good at ignoring our body and these cues. So I'm trying to help people feel that and then learn to manage it and be able to move in and out of it. And so that way it doesn't become something that takes control over them. Because a lot of times they're going to feel it in their bodies at some place before they start getting very reactionary, before they yell, before they scream, before they behave in a way that's inappropriate, before they have a panic attack, before they become abusive, you know, whatever it is that's the problem, is if they can start to learn their own insides of their bodies, then they can stop a lot of these processes. Because once you've become so reactionary that you're in middle brain, it becomes much, much more difficult, if not impossible, to stop that train. So we're trying to teach people to understand their own bodies. And we definitely don't want to feel it when it's super activated, but feeling it, like getting them up to the point where they're feeling a little bit of it, and then figuring out where that is, and then what it feels like, you know. And so I give them like somatic based words. And I have on my website, I have worksheets that are about that somatic. Is it crunchy? Is it hot? Is it tight? Are you nauseous? Do you, you know, and having them start to identify those somatic sensation type words with it. Cause some people have emotions words. A lot of people don't even have those, but most people do not have sensations words.
Right.
So a feeling it into that, And then it's finding the place in their body that feels safe and calm and being able to feel what that's like. And then so they can actually move into that in a deliberate way. So when your nervous system feels out of control, you feel like you're in a car with no brakes, like you're pumping the brakes. You can't, you know, you're in high speed and you're pumping the brakes, or you're completely stalled out. So we go from fight flight, which is like, we're just heading down and I have no way of controlling it, to freeze, which is a completely stalled out car. Either way, you don't have control of the car anymore. And we're trying to give them control of the car back. So when you're able to figure out that what's called that resource spot, that spot in the body that feels very safe for them, then they're able to go in and feel something that feels a little bit difficult and then move back out into the resource spot that feels very safe. So especially if we're doing a lot of trauma work, we talk about the resource spot, where it is, keep them there. And then their plan is, I always say, like, if we're doing a lot of like trauma narrative work, stuff is jiggling loose and you're going to feel this like for a couple of days after a session, mm-hmm. at the least. So if your resource spot is you feel very grounded and rooted in your feet, I want you to go outside and make sure your feet are on the ground. If you can take, you know, your shoes and socks off, do that. If you can go walking, do that. Or remind them to feel into themselves and have activities that relate to that as well. I've only had one client who did not have a body-based resource spot. She had a very significant trauma history of physical illness, so her body literally was very much an enemy. And I'm like, shit, I was never taught what to do with that. So what we did was I said, let's create a safe room in your mind.
Yeah.
And so she had a place that she sort of rent to, like she actually like created this safe room in her mind. Her mind felt safe when her body felt like something that was literally trying to kill her for 20 years. So I've done that in the past. That's the only person I knew who said, like, I have no safe place in my body. And I understood why, because she had, you know, pretty extensive medical trauma. So of teaching them that pendulation of that control of you can downshift, you can go into this safe and secure place and then move back out again. So, and then a lot of times when I'm having them go in and feel something that feels uncomfortable, I'm like, okay, so let's just let it tell you what it needs to tell you. So this isn't me going, okay, I want you to turn it up, or I want you to process through it. What happens when you let yourself feel it? What happens when you let yourself tell you what it wants to tell you? You can process it quietly. You can, and I tell people too, like if I'm in person or doing visual where I can see them, if I notice a change, do you want me to say, hey, I noticed a big difference in your body language right there? What just happened? Or will that kind of kick you out of your process, and do you do better? If you're able to process it, and then you can talk when you're done or talk when you want to. So I always ask people before we get started too, if we're going to do some somatic work, if I notice something, do you want me to say something in the moment? Because I also don't want to disrupt your process and have you have to pull into your prefrontal cortex when you're doing somatic work. And most people say, oh, if you notice something, tell me. But some people want the quiet space. So we have to then, as therapists, learn to be really, really quiet for maybe a lengthy amount of time as they're doing their work. And then they can process with us later. Notice where it goes. Notice what comes up for you. And this is what I call cleaning out the emotional junk drawer, because it's not like we're trying to figure out suppressed memories or anything of that kind of sort of that woo-woo nature. Like it's not going to be stuff that you never remembered before, but it's going to be stuff that we had to sort of fit these pieces back together again. There is a lot of crap in there and you're like, oh, what's this? Oh, this goes over here. The fuck is this? This is the key to a house. I can throw this away. So I talked to you about like whatever's coming up in your body is giving you a chance to release stuff out of your nervous system, things that have been stored in your body, and decide what you want to do with it. You know, how does it make sense in terms of your bigger story? Is it stuff that you don't need anymore? I had a client say recently, like it was all this black guck coming up, but she was able to get it down the drain that way. And it wasn't comfortable, but she was like, oh, I didn't even know all that was there. And that's what kind of dumped it out. She needed to be able to get it up so she could get it out. You know, things that she had been angry about, things that she'd been frustrated about, which again was the holding space to let her do that work.
Yeah. When I start therapy with somebody, whether it's online or in person, and since we're talking about online, I've had to do starting intake online. At those first few appointments when we're just kind of, because my intake is a little bit longer. So when we're talking about the intake, I am also talking about whole body work. Like, this is really intense because we're not just going to talking about like maybe the trauma or the offense behavior, but we're also talking as a whole person, like muscle memory, value systems. And so all of that tapping into the mm-hmm. body, so that from the very get-go, I let them know, like, so if you're uncomfortable, if there's something happening, if I notice something, kind of like how you're talking about, kind of how do I address that with them? They're very aware and consenting to, yeah, tell me, or no, I didn't know. So from the get-go, they're very aware that we're touching a lot of different places, not just cognitively, but also mm-hmm. within the body, to kind of help them recognize. And I explained to them very early on, like, this is why we do this. So they're from the get-go very aware that I'm going to be, you know, kind of talking about a lot of different things, so that we can kind of process through them. And some of my exercises kind of tap into body work, but don't, it's kind of from a distance. So it's like talking about it objectively, but it's kind of from a distance. So they don't mm-hmm. have to necessarily experience it, but they're being made aware of it, that they're just aware that this is a possibility. And they get to move slowly into really doing some of the harder kind of somatic work of kind of really sitting there with the discomfort and kind of really figuring out where it is. Because some people literally don't know that. They have no idea like where it's coming from, anything, like what they feel. You're right. Like we talk about people not having an emotional words, but they don't have that somatic kind of language to understand. Like, I'm really tense. Like, okay. Where do you feel that? They have no idea, even though objectively on our end, we see it in their body. So I think it's important work.
And when people start, yeah. And when people start unpacking that, you can see there's like this, it feels tight. I feel like there's something just like a band around my chest and it really hurts, you know? And like when they actually lean into that, they're like, wow, like this is really awful. I'm really uncomfortable. And like, I've been carrying this around and just kind of shoving it aside. No wonder I'm being bitchy to my kids all the time, or, you know, whatever it is, when they're always so sort of surprised by themselves. It seems like, well, of course people know what's going on in their bodies. We don't.
Yeah.
We don't know, you know, we're told to ignore it and to not address it. And for, you know, especially for those of us who are very sensitive, empathic kids, we were told that we were wrong.
Yeah.
I've had so many people who had experiences where like they were reading stuff in other people or reading stuff in themselves, and they were told, don't talk about that, you're wrong. And so they got used to shutting things down. Yeah. And we need to teach them to trust their bodies again. It's a big part of our work. Go ahead.
When we're talking about significant physical abuse or sexual abuse, how children are taught to just, you hold it. Like, we keep this within ourselves. And so where does all of that energy go? It just stays within us. And so them having to finally acknowledge it and realize that there's all of that stuff still within their body, just kind of ruminating in there and creating for what we're learning about trauma is like medical conditions, right? So it can manifest in so many different ways. And so it is a really challenging thing to help clients work through. So I'm glad we're talking about it. So that's it. What else were you going to say?
Yeah. And so, you know, this is definitely, you know, oh, just saying that there's definitely ways that we can do this online. It doesn't feel as good. We have to be creative with it. Like if you're looking for a brain spot specifically, that, you know, like a lot of times what I do with video is look at the gate, you know, the natural spots that people already find for themselves and point it out. Or, you know, I may do something, I don't use the pointer, but we need a little finger stuff. I mean, we have to kind of adapt to technology, and this is probably going to be the reality of counseling more and more. And our learning curve has been very steep in that process. But it's also not even just like, you know, feeling into your body. It's about coaching all of those things when we're talking. I'll have people that are like, hey, do you want to switch to phone so you can pace? Do you need to pace or fold laundry while we're talking? I've had people, why don't you lay down and put your legs up the wall, which is, you know, a yoga pose. Cause like in my office, we can shove the coffee table aside and we can sit down on the floor and we can do Sufi rolls. I incorporate a lot of yoga and mindful movement. And so I'll coach people to do that on their own. Like, why don't you go ahead and like, you know, put your legs up the wall while you're talking to me. Let's see if that helps. If being in that posture helps, like, and we're not even doing video, so I don't have to see you looking goofy if you're worried about it. Mm-hmm. one of the things, I have it on my blog, and it comes from the book, The Five Wisdom Energies, and I'm just having a hell of a time remembering author names, but I'm doing good on book names, so I can't remember. And I put this exercise on my blog, and I've used it a lot with clients, and so some of my interns may remember it, but I will have, as a sample of what it's like to interocept, to feel your body from the inside, is do the simple exercise. This is something you don't need to see their, see them to do if you're working by phone, is to put out their hand in front of them, and they're doing that with eyes open, and then they're slowly closing the hand and then opening it back up. And just, you know, noticing that, but then you have them do it again with their eyes closed. They close their eyes and do the same thing, and then they're having to feel it from the inside and notice the difference there. Is a good way of sort of teaching interoception, like that noticing the body from the inside, which is very difficult for people. And hands and feet tend to be a safe place to work for people who have, are holding a lot of trauma in the bodies, because the vagus nerve is not, like, by the time you get to these places, that's kind of the end. And so now you're kind of getting into auxiliary nerves. And so it's less activating the hands and feet. So for somebody who has a lot of body-based activation, hands and feet tend to be a really good starting point as well. I mean, there's definitely energy points there, but it's not as strong. And so even that's why things like, if you've seen, they're used for nausea, the little belly bands, the little acupressure bands. I use them for if other people are driving and I get car sick, and they go two fingers down, which is right here, which is, you know, where the primary part of the vagus nerve ends. And I was at a training somewhere and another therapist got really, really anxious. You could see her starting to like break out from this rash. I'm not quite sure what activated for her, and, you know, wasn't my business, but I could tell she was about to have a panic attack. And I gave her the bands and put them there. And so she was literally getting that, you know, pressure right there in the ends. And you could see like the flush and the hives go down. And those are like $5. Those are things that I recommend to clients all the time. I'm always lending mine out. So you're teaching them how to manage their own vagal response of the body, because the body is telling them, hey, there's things to be worried about here. So when we talk about the vagus nerve, I'm talking about the 10th cranial nerve that wanders throughout the body. And the thing that's interesting is we think that the brain is controlling the body, but most of the messaging through the vagus system is afferent. So 80% of it, there's four pathways up from the body to the brain and only one pathway down. So when people are like, I can't control it, I'm like, well, because your body's trying to keep you alive and is designed for you not to control it with your brain. So you have 80% of the messaging is coming from the body to the brain, and only 20% is brain to body. So they're having to learn to work with that super highway of information. So if you know, like, my gut's upset, the gut is going to then tell the limbic system, I'm angry, time to get punchy. Like, it's coming from there. It's starting there first and going up. It's not like I'm, you know, time to get punchy, I'm angry, and then my gut's upset. It's vice versa. So teaching people to, we are much more likely to break the cycle if we're catching the information that the body's giving rather than just focusing like cognitively and behaviorally on what's going on with thoughts and feelings, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the way that I explain it is that our body's going to know it first, and then it kind of comes to us later cognitively, but that our body will tell us when it's something's happened and we're not cognitively aware of it. And so, you know, so we always move into the body, mm-hmm. but that them knowing what their body is doing is incredibly important for their recovery, right? Because that's kind of always where my language goes. Is for your recovery, you do have to know what your body's doing. And so being for us on kind of here, if we can't see them, you know, if you're doing telephone, being able to tap into understanding, like you said, the tone, the pitch, like all of these things are so important to be able to help them, to be able to coach them through that. But I always talk about that, yeah. How our body's going to know because our brain isn't going to catch it yet. So our body's going to listen to your body, right? We have to learn how to listen to our body. And kind of what I talk about is like honoring our body and kind of listening to it and getting reattuned to it and knowing what it's really doing instead of thinking that we're always upcharge in here, because we're not, because it's such a complicated system.
Well, and so Andres, who's in on this video. We did neuro-linguistic programming training together last year. And that was one of the things they talked about, is there is so much information coming in every given second, and there's only so much we can attend to at a conscious level, that the rest of it's downloading and our body is minding it. So it's not a woo-woo thing to say, I was paying attention to playing with the cat, but my body noticed the smell of the cologne that my attacker wore. Right. And so my body is going to have a response to that, even though my conscious brain did not go, oh, that's the cologne that my attacker wore, because my conscious brain is playing with the cat over here. So when you have that gut reaction, it's like, oh, I'm having something in my body. Where's that coming from? And sometimes we can, put together those pieces. Sometimes not. Sometimes our body is just reacting to stuff and we don't even know consciously what it's reacting to, but having to then, redetermine our safety to learn that we can feel that without having it control us, that we can go and feel a little bit, realize that things are okay. And then we start to negotiate with those reactions as well.
I talk about early recovery, talking about, we're going to learn how to manage some of this on the front end, because on the back end, you're going to learn so much that it's not going to feel like managing anymore. Especially when I work with PTSD, it's very much about like, how do we start managing some of this, especially with like soldiers, and the language, of course, has to be a little bit different with them. So they're much more gruffy, what I call gruffy, because they're like all that foo-foo stuff that's something on the back end of recovery that I talk about. They don't want to hear all that. So on the front end, we have to use the language that's going to, resonate with them. So we talk about kind of managing. And then that's where we kind of start integrating some of this, the somatic work, but also the cognitive work, all of these things that are really going to help for them to connect with what we're doing. Somebody dropped off and then I think they came back in. If you heard it.
Yeah. And I'm buffering a lot too. So I keep getting that notification. Any questions from us? I mean, this is one of those things that, certifying in somatics or brain spotting or any like that is, it's a lot of training. This is just a very, one-on-one, but it's not unethical to teach people to like listen to their body a little bit and create container for them to do so they don't get completely disrupted. That being the big thing, is we don't want people to leave with their entrails hanging out or hang up the phone with their entrails hanging out because you said, hey, I want you to feel all that shit. And you go, wow, that was a lot. Well, see you next week.
Yeah.
I think we've all had that experience and we don't want to do that to people. Yeah. But there's definitely some of it that you can do. And it's an important thing to play with yourself. You shouldn't ever ask clients to go somewhere you haven't gone. You need to know the way out, at least for yourself, so you can help them through their process. And also so you can say, like, this is really hard work. When I did my brain spotting training, even when I was doing something really basic, like I just want to work on creativity, I still had mom shit come up. And so you have to be prepared that something you may think may not be heavy work may end up being heavier than you think. When we get somatic, stuff can get heavy. And, to prepare people for that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Faith, Mandy wants to know
good resources for reading about the vagus nerve. Yeah. So the polyvagal theory was originally established mid-90s by Stephen Porges, and he is not a therapist. He was actually interested in trying to increase survival rates for neonatal care. And then Peter Levine was starting to realize something was going on somatically and people were holding stuff in their body around the same time. They had these ideas coming up in the mid-90s, both of them. And now they collaborate and do stuff together. But, Stephen Porges is like, I was not intending for therapists to take over polyvagal theory and make it their thing, but cool. His original book, Polyvagal Theory, is very, very dense. It's about heart rate variability. All this is really interesting. May make you want to bang your head against the wall. Peter Levine has a lot of really good videos on YouTube where he uses a slinky to show how the nervous system works. I mean, there's tons of good stuff out there. One of the people that the Dr. Porges has worked with recently is Deb Dana, and that's D-A-N-A. There's some author names I can actually remember. And so she is a clinician. She is a licensed LMSW. And so she has written a lot about the clinical applications of polyvagal theory, and I think explains it in our kind of clinical language. So if you're not really interested in how heart rate variability, measures vagal tone, which is really interesting to me and like maybe one other person, then I would look at like a Deb Dana's books in particular as how it applies clinically. But anything that Peter Levine has written, Waking the Tiger, those kinds of books are very much about somatic experiencing. And when you start reading them side by side, then you see that they were coming to the same conclusions. Peter was coming to it through clinical work, and Stephen Perez was coming through it from, laboratory research, but they were saying the same thing. So a lot of people were making these realizations, and now the puzzle pieces are starting to fit together. And then when we start getting really into like Eastern medicine and stuff, we're actually seeing then not just what's going on with the vagus nerve, but then how, the fascia holds electrical charges, and that's, a whole big other thing, and how inflammation is stored in the body, and that's a whole big other thing. But those Deb Dana specifically, as the person who, like Stephen Poor has, I think, has like sort of passed the clinical torch onto Peter Levine.
Deb Dana, cool.
Oh, I have one of them here. Oh, I have two of them here. I'm working on my body book right now, so I've been looking at my polyvagal theory stuff again. So these are two of Deb Dana's books that are very specific to Porges's work specifically on polyvagal theory. Like this one just came out. So it's in therapy, and then a lot of exercise-based stuff. So she has exercises in there where she's helping people actually build their personal, because it's very specific. It's specific to our own traumas, our own wiring, our own genetics, our own epigenetics. And so she's, how to help somebody build a map of where, when they're in safety and connection, when they're in fight flight mode, when they're in freeze mode, and helping them build a map so they can learn their own responses in their body. So she's got worksheets that are, because it's all very individual. Somebody may have a reaction to, like I said, a cologne, but nobody else would have that kind of reaction to. So it's about helping people realize that, and that connects the body stuff to then, where did that come from stuff.
Yeah. Well, what do
there's also like a, oh, go ahead.
What do you think, Faith, about maybe for new therapists who are kind of really having to maneuver through COVID-19 when they don't necessarily have like all the trainings, right? How can they manage or begin to explore with their clients some somatic experiencing?
Say that again, because you were buffering and I caught none of it.
Okay. So how do you think, is it better? How do you think that a new therapist or even therapist, because I think that a lot of therapists may not always do some of the somatic work. How can they, now that through COVID-19, kind of really start exploring some of this in a way that wouldn't be harmful? She still didn't hear anything I said.
I heard COVID-19 and wouldn't be harmful. Like this is, going supremely well.
New therapists? I don't know if that would be helpful. New therapists, like how can new therapists, I gotta type. And I only type one thing at a time.
How can new therapists?
Yeah, who are engaging in wanting to engage and starting doing some of the somatic work, how can they do it without being harmful, right? So being an early therapist.
I think.
Because
so,
I.
I think a lot of people.
Go ahead.
I think, like Mandy said, starting with reading and understanding it conceptually is a good way to start. I know that a lot of people are trying to move the trainings into platforms like this, and then we have to deal with the wonkiness of like, hi, I didn't hear your question three times, which always works super well. I know that brain spotting is moving to online platforms right now, like yoga teacher trainings. Everybody is trying to adapt to our circumstances to make sure that people can continue to get training, and how do we make that quality. In the process. I think with starting with stuff like the hands and feet exercise, using the one from the Five Wisdom Energies with the hand is a very safe way to start. I always tell people too, I'm like, we have different options. And so if people are interested in doing something that's very somatic, like brain spotting, and they're like, oh, let's do that. And I'm like, okay, well, we're not going to do it today. Like, I want you to go do some reading on it. Go, look at videos at YouTube. I have an extra copy of David Grand's brain spotting book in my office that I'll lend out for them to read. Go look it up and see if it makes sense for you. And then even then people are just like, yeah. And they're like, whoa, that was a lot. I'm like, okay, so what do we need to do differently next time? Like, even if you have all kinds of safeties and, I always err to like be very, very careful with people. Stuff can get activating when we're doing trauma work and saying, okay, so what do we need to do differently? So we definitely have to do that again. Okay. And so if a session ends up being a lot more than they thought, is at least giving them power back. And do we need to not do this again? Or do we need to adapt it in a way so it's more manageable? So we talk through that and they can be mad at me in the process. That was a lot and I don't like you right now. Okay. Yeah, it sounds like a lot and I wouldn't like me either. How do we do this differently? And so owning that process of feedback. So I want them. And then if we're doing something somatic, because somatics is a lot, I'll say, okay, so read on it. If you decide you want to do it, we'll do some next session and let's do like 20 minutes. So if it's not a great thing for you, you didn't like waste your whole session doing something that you didn't like. And it's not a lot. And so if it's a lot for you, you're not doing like an hour's worth of a lot, and we have time to talk about other stuff and process that. So that's how I kind of step people into anything that I think is going to be a particularly difficult work. Yeah. And well, like with some clients too, people with PID, for example, that's going to be a long process before we get to that. I need to get the protector parts on board. There's so much other work that I need to do before I have any chance of that being viable. In fact, I get very frustrated when people who have, some diagnosis that are very, very interpersonal trauma reactive, and someone's like, okay, well, we're just going to do EMDR for that. And then they go home and this shit hits the fan. Yeah. Depending on the severity of the case, I would, be very, very careful to, have a very good and strong relationship with them. Not like, hi, I'm Faith and this is what we're doing today. And they've never met me before. It's never going to happen.
Right. Yeah. I believe in baby steps. So even when we're doing heavy work, I'm like, let's baby chomp this. Like, we're going to take a little bite. We're going to feel it out. We're going to do a lot of processing through it. Because I would rather us work slower than jump into something that is going to turn into a shit show, right? So we kind of baby step. Mm-hmm. And even with that, though, it's very helpful and like for people who manifest in overfunctioning, like it's very important for them to kind of understand how to like slow it down, right? They don't have to 100% all the time, right? So there's these little baby skills that wind up falling into some of that work before we get to the really tough work, because we want a solid foundation when we get to that solid work and that really tough work. So that's always important.
And a lot of that comes, so those who don't know, that Brenda and I did TFCBT training together like a trillion years ago. And one thing, and that's trauma-focused CBT, and that's designed for kids. And the thing that's different and interesting about it that I'm really glad I had that first is that a lot of the trauma-focused stuff for adults, like cognitive processing therapy, prolonged exposure, doesn't teach like the grounding and the coping skills first. It just jumps in. And TFCBT, you teach the grounding and the coping skills first before you even touch anything else. And I think that that's probably a lot of where it comes from, is we did that, I don't know, like close to 10 years ago now. And so I don't understand why you would only do that with kids and not with adults. Right. Everybody needs to be able to have something solid to stand on. I don't want to be another person who disempowers or traumatizes somebody by taking control of the situation. It's theirs. Like, this is their process, their work. I'm like, you're the one driving the car. I'm in the backseat. I have a map, so I can find us like different ways to get there. If it gets really dark, I have a flashlight, but you're driving this car. And I tell people that all the time. And so they need to be re-empowered in their process. Everybody's heard me say, it's not that people resist change, we resist being changed. So if it feels like we are another person enforcing some change, it's not going to work. They might be compliant because they're, court ordered or whatever, but it's not going to be real work unless it's something they decide they want to do.
Yeah. Mandy's asking, how do you baby step with littles?
With itty bitties, I do a lot of, having them be in their bodies, a lot of play-based stuff, more Adlerian type play where it's not necessarily free play where you're just, watching them, but you're actually teaching them to manage their behavior through play. A lot of somatic stuff, like my oldest, I think, was just born with a very raw nervous system. And we used to do stuff called crabby stretching. I didn't tell him we were doing yoga. I said, oh, we're supposed to be crabby. Let's get down on the floor and do some crabby stretching. Oh, get the crabbies out. So that kind of stuff of learning to be in their body with that and the somatic toys. And Mandy, I know that you do a lot of that already, that you have a very somatic type space set up, is, letting them play and do that and express themselves through that, but you can also guide that process. So it's not, where you're just kind of watching them play for an hour and going, oh my goodness, you got a lot out, but helping them use that process to, to manage themselves.
Yeah.
Because kids don't know. If you go, why are you so angry? And you go, I don't know. I like chocolate milk. Do you like chocolate milk? And you're not going to get anywhere with that. So
I know when I work with littles, and I'm kind of transitioning away from working with small children, but I very much what I consider play, and I'm not any kind of registered play therapist, but I use creativity as a way to connect with them. So I have the scissors, and we'll have construction paper and hula hoops. And we talk a little bit about, I think with most of the children, I'll talk a little bit about boundaries first, right? Just so that they can get an idea of like, what does it feel like to be close to someone? What does it feel like to be far away from someone? And so that they can begin to kind of conceptualize that there is a difference, right? That there's, when I don't want to hug creepy Uncle Joe, that's like legit, right? If my Uncle Benny doesn't want me hugging him, like that's okay too. But then that starts to help them to understand that just within our bodies, we do feel things. So I will use the hula hoops as kind of part of that. Or I do chains. I build little chains with them, and we get to build it bigger if they don't know me. We build it smaller.
I've done arms out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've done like strips of paper, same thing, the change. Even just arms out can be helpful with that. And tell them too, I don't want to hug Uncle Timmy. He smells weird. Part of our job is to go back and help advocate for that with their guardian, their parent, is so the parent can say, hey, Josie's wanting space for her body and doesn't feel comfortable hugging Uncle Timmy. So I need you to back Josie up on that. That's really important for her to understand that she's allowed space for her body. Right. And I say it just like that. It's not like, we're trying to establish good boundaries here and apparently Timmy stinks. It's just like, I want her to know that she's allowed to have space for her body.
Yeah.
And I want you to help back her up on that. That's exactly how I say it, and it's very simple, and it doesn't become a deep thing, and we're not having a fight about Timmy. It just,
right. When I work with, because I do, I don't know if y'all can hear, they're doing yard work, but when I'm working with littles, and especially now through COVID-19, there are some clients of mine that are children that just manage a little bit better online because we get to watch videos and then we get to conversate. I get to see their room. There's all of the things that I get to interact with that I couldn't ever do in the office. But I wind up getting on the computer with all of them. So I have like mom on the computer, and I have, because everybody has a tablet and a computer. And so then we just kind of have a conversation, and the kiddos really like that because it's really interesting. And we'll talk about things like personal space. We'll talk about all of these things that are really important. And it's not really an argument. It's like, it's collaborative, right? Like, hey mom, like, blah, 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 how do we help this? So that's always important as well, as the family for littles. I do a lot of education with my families as well. Like, they're with their kids 24/7. I need buy-in from my parents, because they're really the ones that are going to be reinforcing all of the stuff that we're doing in session. And so, like, even at home, like, they're the ones really reinforcing everything. So they have to kind of really be aware of and understand how we're moving forward. So being able to tell mom or grandma or whoever, like, hey, the kids want some space, right? They don't want to go outside and play with the dog because they're scared of the dog, and they were never able to verbalize that before, but now they have. So that's always important, as well as getting the parents on board.
Yeah.
And understanding. Yeah.
And you can with the parents too, is I don't want the parents to ever feel like I'm trying to corner them and let the kid run rampant. So the kid is like, you know, fuck that bitch, and I'm not going to do anything until she gives me my switch back. Then, you know, they're hoping that we're going to gang up and, you know, get the switch back. And so, like, okay, well, let's get your mom. Okay. So I heard the switch got taken away. I understand why. What does she need to do to get the switch back? And so then we're having a different conversation with it and pulling in the family too, of, you know, how does she need to say that? And so you're kind of pulling in the parents, and so they don't feel cornered, they feel supported, and the kid is also feel, you can do it in a way where everybody feels supported in that process of, you know, that conversation has gone through the roof. And so then, and mom's like, I don't know, stop your shit. It's been whatever the conversation's going on at home. And we can bring that down to, okay, so this is what I'm needing for you. I'm needing you to not, you know, cuss me out. I'm needing for you to not take your brother's shit. These are the things that need to happen. If that happens for 3 days, then you can have your switch back. And so then mom doesn't feel like, you know, we're going over mom's head, and the kid doesn't feel that they're not being heard. So, you know, you can, I've absolutely had, okay, well, why don't you go get your mama and bring her in for this part of the conversation, and do that all the time. Yeah.
Well, and even with the littles, you know, when we do like boundaries and we do all of these little creative things, I'll ask my kiddos, especially if they're expressing something that they've never expressed before. So if they'll say something like, oh, I feel really nervous about this, we'll bring the parents in to help them understand that. And I'll always ask the kid, well, do you want to explain? Right? Because a kid wants to explain too. I'm like, how do you help your mom understand this? So they'll get really excited about talking to their parents about this because they've never done it before and it's exciting for them. And so with me in the room, then I'm able to clarify. So they get to say it the way they understand it. And then I get to clarify. And that way my parents get to reinforce all of that at home, right? So the adults will tell the children, hey, well, what did you and Brenda talk about? We talked about you being nervous about this, right? So now they're able to kind of encourage them to be much more open with something or verbal, or to experience the feeling of, right? The parents get to kind of notice when that child is engaged in some kind of activation or if they're upset. So there's a lot of benefit to having littles and having the parents kind of collaborate with us in terms of like what we're doing in the room, because they get to explain it and it's exciting and they understand and they get to reinforce all of it once they leave. Because usually I only see kiddos one
thing. And I always do a lot of big heaping praise with parents, the parents too. I was saying, I do a lot of big heaping praise with parents too, when they actually, oh, okay, I hear that or whatever. And I say, you know, like, I grew up in a home where nobody really gave a shit about what I was saying and was willing to negotiate. You may or may not have had the same thing. So we're having to learn to be parents in a way that our parents weren't. And I really appreciate you doing this right now. Like, this is not how we were parented. And so you're doing this big, amazing thing. And this kid is so lucky to have you do this work with them. And so not just praising the kid, but praising the parent for supporting the kid. And sometimes the kid's like, you know, she's only doing this and being reasonable because you're here. And I'm like, well, then that makes it a good hour of your day then, if you're going to be able to have a conversation then, snarky butt. So that's okay. Yeah. But I make a big deal of that too, you know, because most of the parents are going to be, you know, about my age or so, you know, Gen X parents of Zoomer kids. And so I make a big point of like, that is not how we were parented. That was not what the expectations were. And we're having to parent in a very different way. And I really appreciate that this is hard work for you too.
Yeah.
Um, And like, if a parent like apologizes to their kid or whatever, I'll make a point to the kid. I'm like, that is huge. I did not grow up in a house where a parent apologized to me and your parent just apologized to you. They don't mean it. And I'm like, I think they do. And also, oh my God, they fucking apologized to you. Again, I grew up in a house where that never happened.
Yeah.
You know, kind of stuff. And so, and then the parents are on board too. It just doesn't become, you know, here's the fucking therapist telling me to do this thing, you know, and basically saying I'm a bad parent is, you know, whatever that the message that they internalize with that. If we support them and, you know, and praise that effort of doing something that's very different for them.
Yeah, definitely. It's all hard work. It's all hard work, and it's really helpful, but I think we really do need to move slowly when we're doing the somatic work. Even with littles, even with adults, because at the end of the day, they're trusting us with their vulnerability. So being able to move slowly is really, at least from me, from my perspective, just moving slowly. And, you know, I always talk about consent with my clients because it's like, I always want you to be aware of what's going to happen. And so me kind of explaining everything, and it's like, here we go again, Brenda's talking, but it's like, because I want you to understand what's going to happen. I don't want any surprises. Like, you've been there already. You've already had, you know, whether it's trauma, or, you know, offending behaviors, like you've already had all of that. Like, we want this to be such a safe place that we're going to move slowly. There's not going to be any kind of surprises. And I'm always going to help you kind of put it back together at the end. So you're not going to leave with your, like you would say, faith, your entrails kind of leaving behind you when you leave. So I do two small chunks of time, like, okay, we're going to do this for like 5 minutes, and we'll build up to do more as you're learning how to manage in a safer way. So all of that is important to understand, I think, as a clinician. Moving into like,
well, yeah. And another thing that we're doing is we're modeling a healthy relationship, right? We're teaching people that healthy relationships are based in consent. And when we talk about things like boundaries, boundaries are our everyday expression of consent for interaction, right? So if we model that with them, we're teaching them what they should allow in their space and should not, especially as they get older. With adults, like, why are you in a toxic relationship? You don't have to do this. Like, you know, Faith and Brenda don't treat me this way. Why would I let anyone treat me this way? And with kids, it's, you know, maybe I'll end up being a different kind of parent than I was treated, or, you know, whatever it is. But we're showing people what a healthy relationship looks like. And it may be the first time they've ever seen it, that you're in charge of this. You're here to do work, and I'm going to help you with that work, but you're in charge of how this. And I'm gonna work really hard to hold you through this work. I don't want it to be terrifying and scary. I don't want you to feel pushed. And we all know therapists who've done that. And like that is like my number one thing that I'm always desperately trying to avoid. I already know that it's hard work, and I definitely don't want to make it worse. Yeah. So we're showing them what a healthy relationship looks like.
Right. Yeah. So the consent that I do has four qualifiers for it. So sometimes I'll even go over what that consent really means, because most people, anyway, and that's a whole other topic, but just talking about consent is sometimes important as well in helping people understand what real consent, or what we call true consent on my end, what true consent is. So it's all challenging work.
Active continuous consent, yes.
Yeah. So how about we stop here? What do you think, Faith?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Did anybody have questions before we go?
Anything that you wanted to say now that we're no longer recording? So...